Has the federal government officially waged war against its own states? Well, in America, that's what we're watching, and we're watching the states try to decide whether they should side with other states in this battle or if they should join the fight along with the federal government to quash this. We've seen this before in America. Is it getting to the same realm? That's what we're going to try to answer today. With me, I got my main host, Andrew. We're going to bust it down and see if Trump, Biden, or either of these people trying to represent us in this next election actually have the power or the guts to stop the issues that we're actually seeing at our southern border. Let's get talking. Talk about this thing that's in my brain. It keeps me from wanting to go on, but I want some game. Maybe a little fame. We just went over, we were doing pre-show, just a little bit of research just to establish. All we hear is talking points, and we were kind of talking about it. All you hear is what one side wants you to see, and it's cool in a way. We live in an age where if you're going to go on any of these apps that you want to engage in, it could be YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, if you're a Facebook user, any of these platforms are going to start to tailor what they show to you to what you want to see, what you like, what you engage in, right? How much time you spend on a post is going to warrant what they're going to send your way next, what's in your suggested feed. And that's great, except for when you get into an information war or when you get into times like these when it's actually beneficial to one side of the aisle or another to put out information that is purposefully disinforming one side of the public or another, right? It could be to dumb down their own political side to get them to buy in more. It could be to dumb down the other side and try to bring them down to a level of not understanding any complexity in the situation, being overrun by information, right? You're seeing both kinds of attacks. And when you see this type of information breakdown in warfare, it's hard to follow subjects like the southern border crisis. Would you care to elaborate on that any further, Andrew, before we keep going?
I think you hit the nail on the head, and absolutely. A lot of what you see on social media is a direct cause of what you seek out yourself, right? So in a way, these social media apps aren't going to necessarily push what they want in a way. There's arguments and evidence for and against that, obviously, but I think Twitter's probably your best bet in trying to seek out what you want to see. But it will also strategically, we were talking about this pre-show as well, it'll strategically present you with something that it thinks may trigger you. So in a way, it'll show you something or trigger you, right? So it'll show you something that it thinks you may disagree with, right? To kind of keep you in check a little bit, so that it doesn't seem like you're in an echo chamber as much.
I agree. I think that Twitter or X now is the best at doing that. But even in the same way, it's putting, like, it knows what it's doing. It's putting the ones in front of you that are either, I would say, obscure views that are easy to disagree with, or they're putting in front of you, like a lot of what I see is comment sections. So like, it's like, I'm obviously going to click on this to see what people want to say. And I think that's kind of going after the intellectually curious of us, the ones who want to know, not necessarily going to go espouse my opinion on this. It's pretty controversial or it's not necessary, but I do want to see what others' opinions are. And it does put a lot of those instances in front of your face when you're in a situation like me. I'm trying to read the room, right? You're saying I'm trying to see both sides of the coin, and it's a battleground now
on Twitter. I'm sure Twitter takes that out there that you like to see a lot of different points of view and that you click on a lot of different posts, read a lot of.
I think that's why I see so much of it.
Because not all content on Twitter is like that. And I'm sure not everyone has the same experience on Twitter as you do.
Nobody does, right?
Simply because there's a lot of dumb content out there too. And if you don't embrace yourself in a lot of that, if you don't immerse yourself in that, then I think that's not really what it's going to show you for the most part.
I agree. It was really interesting to see, though, the chain of events here following the Supreme Court's decision to hinder Texas's ability to control its own border. Yep. So this decision, by the way, I cannot seem to find what this decision's wording actually was. Have you been able to?
I have not.
Find it and read it.
It's quite clear because the media has been making a whole stink out of it, especially the right wing media. But I've heard a few independent sources that it doesn't necessarily mean what we think it does.
And that's what I've been trying to find on my own, because, you know, if this is what they want to say, they're disallowing Tesla's ability to put razor wire. Okay. Well, if that's really the wording of the law, and I can 100% guarantee you that's not the wording of the law.
It's not.
What else is in there, and why has it triggered this reaction from Texas and its seemingly allied states? It's either got to be, you know, it's either got to be a slippery slope that's being crossed, has been crossed, already has been crossed, and this is just a step of the line, or there's wording in there that is actually devious that we just don't understand or we're not seeing, which is, again, why I'm struggling to comprehend why I can't find the wording on this ruling.
It shouldn't be this hard to find the wording on the ruling or the majority opinion. And even the dissenting opinion, I know I haven't seen it pop up in front of me, but...
Oh, I found it. I found it. Okay, here we go. Order in pending case, Department of Homeland Security, and Alabama, it looks like. It says ETAL, period. So it's an abbreviation for something. Not exactly sure. But it's First Texas. The application to vacate an injunction presented to Justice Alito and by him referred to the court is granted the December 19, 2023 order of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Where's the fucking... Yeah, but where's the decision?
So I found something from CNN.
Yeah, but if you click it into the thing from CNN, you can get to the original document, but that's where I'm struggling to find.
So maybe that could be...
It's just interesting to me that you would see this reaction, though, because there must have been maybe a leak of what was actually talked about. Maybe the vote was taking place, but they didn't want to publicize the decision yet, and somebody leaked it. You know, I'm trying to follow the logic here of why Texas would react in the way it did. And we can find Texas Governor Abbott's response letter to the Biden administration. And did you get a chance to read it? Because I can go through its major points here.
Yeah, go through its major points.
Just give me a moment. Okay. All right. So this one was easy to find. This is why I don't understand why the other one can't be. All right. So basically what it's saying is that President Biden has failed to do his duty on the southern border. It cites multiple instances in the Constitution in which he did fail. And it's not actually really an indictment on this alleged Supreme Court ruling that's happened over the past month. It's actually more an indictment on what he's done in his whole entire presidency and neglection of the border in its entirety. So what it is calling on states to help his situation in which they can't actually properly process as many people coming through their border at once. That is the entirety of the letter, and I'll link it in the description here so everybody could read its fine text. But my main point in saying that is that it's not in any way, shape, or form targeted at this previous decision, right? So it tells me something simmering, and possibly that there's more to this Supreme Court case than we know about. Or to be honest, maybe that's just what they wanted to use as the powder keg to light the fuse, right? Let's take a second and be honest, and let's see if we can agree on something here, Andrew. America is a tinderbox right now. There are political tensions that have never been higher. And you could say 2016, you could say 2020, or you could say 2012, second Obama term. I honestly don't think anything is worse because it's getting worse. Like, this is all leading into each other, and everybody is upset for this long period of time that, I'll be honest, we all know as Americans, there's a certain amount of us elites that think we're controlling things, but I think most normal Americans know that neither one of the leading people on the ticket of either respective party actually represents us very well. They don't actually represent what we want. And I think that most Americans can agree on that.
Yeah,
the other thing is, most Americans would agree the candidate they're going to be voting for in the next election is the better of the evils, better of the two evils.
Yeah, lesser two evils.
we've been doing the lesser of the two evils for so long now. We've dug ourselves a really, really deep grave. These people do not have our best interests at heart. And I think now we're seeing it's rearing its ugly head to the point where we're both sides of the aisle. And I don't even put myself on a side anymore, but being simplistic, both sides of the aisle are upset with the candidate they have to vote for, but they're doing it out of pure hatred.
Right.
When you get to that point, it's not just federal politics, state level politics, your governors, they realize that this is an opportunity to seize on emotions, right? Seize on us as Americans being ginned up as a population. And if I had ventured to say, I'm not saying that Governor Abbott is trying to stoke the flames of a fire that he thinks is already going here. What I am saying is maybe it's an opportunity for him to solve a problem internally rather than relying on a Trump victory. And if you rely on a Trump victory, something I want to really get to talk about in this show is Trump really going to solve your problem at the border? Or is he just going to kick the can along down the road just like he seems to have done?
Yeah.
Right. So are you really going to rely on Trump as your president, even if he wins, if you're Governor Abbott? Right. That could be where
Congress, which was Trump's whole point in not getting the border wall done in his first term.
Right. So I think we could pretty simply agree on that, though, that there is a tinderbox that you can use to resemble America right now. And I'm not sure if Greg Abbott purposefully just lit it, but it's very possible that he did.
Another thing I was thinking is, why hasn't Greg Abbott done this sooner? Why didn't he try to install razor wire, deploy the Texas National Guard a little bit sooner? If this was such a terrible...
This is not an uncommon opinion. It's very common opinion on Twitter as well. The problem is, there is an ideology capture, I believe, that's taking place on both sides of the political aisle.
Yep.
Ideology capture is weird, though, on the Republican side. And let me explain why. On the Democrat side, you have a wholehearted hatred for Trump. That's what it is. That's what they're voting for at this point. If Trump's not the nominee, they are going to struggle to put out people to vote. It's just a fact. It's not their fault, but they've aimed their entire campaign from the federal level on down to the local level that we are anti-MAGA. It's just what they are.
Yeah.
Now, the big dilemma on the Republican side is we can't agree with each other that Trump is the best person to do the job.
Yeah.
That is not to blame the Republicans, and to be honest, I'm one of those Republicans who has a lot of question marks there. But that being said, when you talk about the ability to get things done politically, that is a huge, huge obstacle for the Republicans. It's massive. Yeah. It really is. And you just have to think, if you are, you know, just like we have people pulling strings on the Democratic side that we're all afraid of, there's people pulling strings on the Republican side. There's people who I believe are more powerful than Donald Trump ever was. There's people who hold more ability to pull together political connections and get things done in America on the Republican side that are bigger than Donald Trump. I do believe that, but they can't let you know that. They need to use Trump to get there.
I think he underestimated that big time. I don't think he
I think he did too. And I think that I'm glad you can agree on that. I think that, and I'm curious what you think, I think that's the Trump we're seeing now, because he's in a position where he cannot have his own political opinions anymore, because somebody else is footing his legal bills, somebody else is keeping him afloat, and he has to say and do the things that are going to not only make the people that are paying for his trip happy, but I think, generally speaking, they hold his future in their hands, his entire future, right? If they wanted to, they could cave to the left side and just let him hang, I believe. They don't want that. At least a certain amount of his donors don't. That's why I think you see the Trump you see today.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't think just because he has donors, I don't know that he's that influenced by them. I don't know that that's changed. But what I think is that he underestimated the true capacity and ability of this network of, I guess, what he would call the swamp.
Right.
And how they kind of got in the way of some of his legislation, different things he was proposing. One of them being, remember, drain the swamp, right? I'm going to go after Hillary Clinton.
When's the last time you heard that, though? Because the real drain the swamp message was
sworn in as president the first time, right? And I think that's when reality really set in, when he started to really realize how extensive,
deep, and deep and interconnected it is.
Yeah, or how deep this deep state really was, right? And I'm sure that there's things that he hasn't said that we can't even speculate, that he knows, that, you know, if he was to move forward with this, 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 or that, you know, maybe he would be threatened, other things would be threatened. I think there's a lot of factors at play with that.
Right. So when you get into this discussion, though, with Trump, what the biggest question in my head is he's the best person to represent the Republican Party at this point? And this is actually a question that I've already asked you, I think. So we'll revisit this question. Okay.
Yeah, we can.
I've asked you before. I think this was before any of the – I think the trials were impending. I think there was at that point like 70-some-odd indictments, and I asked you this question. But now that he's going through these trials, and you just saw the first – I believe the first civil case decision just came down yesterday on the Eugene Carroll case.
Okay. Yep.
With that finally coming out yesterday, it was very well timed to the point. And this could have been a move by the Democrats. It could have been coincidence. Everything in politics is always a coincidence, right? There's probably a reason for everything. Trump did not say a word about the border yesterday at all. Meanwhile, you had 25 or 26 fellow governors of states siding with Abbott in his decision to self-defend the border that is representing the country.
That is interesting. Do we know for a fact that he hasn't said anything?
Well, I went all over his truth. I did the investigation myself. I was curious as to, you know, because this all started out on Thursday. Thursday was when Abbott released his letter, but it was later in the day. And Biden had said that Texas has 24 hours. This is the, I believe Biden press sent this out. So it wasn't Biden himself saying this, but basically said Texas has 24 hours to negate everything it just didn't said. You're not going to reinstate your razor wire. You're not going to do this. That was actually a statement sent out by the Biden White House.
Okay.
And Texas,
any reaction to that?
Nothing to that. He had nothing to that. Yeah. So on Thursday, I believe he said this, that our border is in a crisis state, but this was before Abbott even sent anything out. So,
yeah.
So it was just like he was sending out like information to his voters, basically, or propaganda, you could say, or whatever he wanted to get out to his people.
The border's a mess. So it's kind of like stating the obvious, but like what specifically, like if he was really trying to talk to, I guess, his voters.
You get what I'm saying, though? It was his old-time tweets. It was like when he was back on Twitter, he was just saying, Southern border's a mess. Millions of people are coming across every single year.
I think if he was trying to make a bigger point, like you would try to say, like, he would describe kind of what's going on and why this is different than
exactly. Exactly. That's my point, is he made no statement and he said nothing on truth or on Twitter on anything. There was nothing said by Trump actually talking about the scenario with Texas and Governor Abbott. And there was only information on him trying to defend himself, and especially with the Eugene Carroll case. And to a point, you can understand that, especially about a man. But when you're talking about you're running a race trying to represent the country, and you don't even have a word to say in support of this governor who just went out on a limb, basically for you, this person is really stooping for your policies. If you got behind him, this would be a massive, massive political win for Trump, and he didn't take it. And you wonder why.
I don't know that Greg Abbott did it strategically for Trump. I think he genuinely.
I'm not saying he did. I'm saying the opportunity presented itself, Trump didn't take it. Trump didn't take it at all.
Yeah, I don't think Greg Abbott did it for Trump necessarily, you know, to help him or to kind of present him the opportunity. I think he genuinely believes that Texas is being invaded, whether or not you agree with that. And I think he genuinely believes that he has the power.
I agree with that as well. I apologize if it made it seem like Greg Abbott was trying to shoot up for Trump. Yeah, no, I'm just saying, the opportunity was put in front of Trump's face in order to.
If I'm a senior advisor to Trump, I'm saying, listen, we should probably take advantage of this. Like,
take advantage of the situation that's at hand.
We stand behind Greg Abbott and the 26 other states that are staying.
And we would hope, and not even that, and we would hope that more states join. Try to, like, that's an opportunity for you to chip away at the Democratic bloc.
Absolutely.
That's the question that comes to my mind. And, you know,
that know the border is a mess and actually may or may not sort of support.
A lot of them live near it.
Yeah. That's right.
And it doesn't matter how they vote. There is an innate human feeling to having your society and culture overrun. It doesn't matter how, like I said, how you feel or how you vote. You have underlying feelings. And when it's, you know, your doorstep that's getting knocked down, right? When you, when you're starting to see your neighbors or your friends getting put in situations, like maybe they're not even in violence, but they're getting directly affected by it. They're on a subway. And there's people who are just not even native to this country, but they're starting fights with each other and causing violence to spread, right? And this stuff's not getting policed, right? As we see this in certain places where it's cropping up. Not only are they being allowed to walk in freely, but it's not being policed the crimes that they might be committing. And that's that, you start to see a, you know, the opposite of a exponentially good effect happening when you start to see good policy implementation and people working behind it. You actually start to see the deterioration. Right? Yeah. And this is something that my parents have talked about exceedingly throughout my childhood about what New York City used to be like before it got cleaned up by Huckabee and Giuliani. Right. But before it got cleaned up, it was basically what we're looking at in New York City right now, or worse.
I still think probably worse, but it's getting there. I know you're, yeah, you're right. You're totally right. From everything I've researched and heard firsthand, New York was in the 80s, 90s, early 90s, a nasty place, supposedly. So.
All right. I wasn't living at that time. It goes to show how young and naive I am. You can all go make fun of me and Andrew, and that's fine. But
you're going to say it. Yeah. Whatever.
You can go do your research all you want, and you'll come up with the same things that I'm coming up with. And you can call me racist, because that's where your next line of attack is going to be against me or Andrew, is that we're racist for pointing this out. If you, all right, so one of the biggest things that happened after after the death of MLK. So after the death of MLK, you saw a lot of people that not only supported him, but were in his communities as well, that he was affecting majorly, didn't believe in his message anymore, right? Violence had to be the answer because his peace message got him killed. And when you look at the ramifications that that had on the country as a whole over the next couple of decades before it started to simmer down, you actually saw a massive shift in the country to the right side. All right. And this is when you saw the only way that a Democrat really got elected coming out of this real horror show of mismanagement policy was actually siding to the right. And you got to see what Bill Clinton was. But Bill Clinton's internal policies, right? So other than some of his foreign policy that he got himself into and some of the problems that he started that we're still dealing with today, a lot of his internal policy was quite conservative. And that was really so that he can win the vote. He was not going to win.
Well, granted, it was just, where was he from? He was governor of Arkansas. He won a lot of the southern states. At that point, he was still seen as a traditional blue dog Democrat.
Blue dog Democrat, right.
One of the good old boys, right? I mean, it really, especially now, couldn't be further from the truth. But I'm not really sure how he was interpreted back then, especially when he was running for president. But I'm not necessarily sure if that was a facade or if that was accurate. I mean, because there were
it could have been how he really felt, but it's what he needed to do to win. That's what I think you historically need to look back on. That's not how he felt, but that's the politician in him said, and it worked in saying, I need to do this to win. Otherwise, I have no chance. If I don't move my policy.
That's my question, because I haven't researched that as much. And I remember seeing pictures of old Clinton campaign memorabilia. And one of them was like Confederate flags with Clinton 96 on it. Literally, Confederate flags with Clinton 96. Like,
listen, my only point in bringing all this up is that when times come like this, you're going to get a snapback in the not only the culture, but the voting strategies of Americans, right? So how they interpret this. My only concern is that on the whole, right-wing policy is not much better. If anything, it's really a carbon copy of what the Democrats are doing. And I don't think it's their fault. But think about it. Think about things along this train of thought with me.
From the opposite perspective.
So think about my train of thought here, and I think it's got to be pretty close to the truth. The American policy has been tending left since Clinton, essentially. So ever since that stopping, and like I said, what Clinton had to do to get elected, he changed as a person and as a president as he governed. And of course, you're going to get to institute a little bit more policy that is, you know, generation or legacy giving in your second term. So you need to get reelected for that second term, and then you can start instituting the policy that you deem to be necessary, right?
Because at that ever point, since second term, you're a lame duck from day one, essentially.
Once you're out of there, you got nothing. So you might as well use up what power you got. And from that moment on, I believe you saw a huge skew to the left. And like I said, I'm still not alive at this point. I'm just becoming born as Bush is taking over. And as are you, a few months before me. And we're watching this American policy skew to the left, I think, our whole lifetime. Even under Trump, you know, the massive expenditures that were spent, the donor class that got a lot of the tax cut money that he likes to talk about.
Yeah.
A lot of that money was actually stored up and is at this moment a part of the wealth that is making up the people that we are talking about, those elites, those people who really don't live at the same day to day as me and you.
That's right.
We've watched that. And I do think there's got to be a snapback. I think there's got to be a snapback, but there also has to be a realization that I am, for one, don't think that the current Republican Party can govern in a conservative way. It's been so long since we've governed conservatively. It's a new ballgame in 2024. So much new technology. There's a lot more international policy necessity, whereas back in the 80s, back in the 90s, you can get away with a lot of isolationism. Now, foreign trade is necessary. We're not going to be able to produce everything we need to function as a society in America. We're just not going to be able to do it, especially not from day one of a presidency.
Not from day one. It'll take work, but I'm not convinced that us as Americans that we can't do that. I think
I'm not saying we can't, but I'm saying it's going to take a good politician to get us out of that, right? It is a weaning off system. It's not a dead cut cold turkey system.
It's not. It's not going to be cold cut turkey. It's going to have to be several presidents over several terms working.
And I don't know if we have that.
When you have Trump maybe trying to do it in 2016, then you have Biden for another 4 years who was undoing all that, then Trump again, then who knows who gets elected in 2028 and so forth, right? So it needs to be kind of like a progressive movement. And one of the parties needs to be united. And I don't see that in either one of the parties now, right? You have a lot of moderate Democrats are becoming independents now because the Democratic
Party
itself has become so progressive. And then you have
John Fetterman. You've been watching John Fetterman at all?
Oh, yeah. They're talking about him being Trump's VP pick. But then with the Republican side, you have the
Cheney. I would like that a lot.
Honestly.
I would like that a lot.
You have the Cheney Republicans, you have the Mitt Romneys, the John McCains, and then you have the rest of the Republican Party, which is solidly behind Trump. And I think a big part of what you're talking about, of the country shifting to the left, especially expenditure-wise, is a result of those Bush-like Republicans, McCain-like Republicans, Romney-like Republicans.
Absolutely.
100. There's
on the surface, no doubt.
Spending money, they're just as bad. They always were, and still want to be. Again, Nikki Haley's another one. They always were, and still want to spend like there's no tomorrow.
I agree, man. So I guess I'll re-ask this on our way out here. Do you think that Trump best represents the conservative vision going forward at this point?
You know, I almost feel like that's a setup question in a way, but like, I honestly, yeah, I don't see who else would be. Now, can you find someone else who is a younger version of Trump, who's more articulate, who has less baggage? Maybe, but I don't know who that is at this point. What okay. I'm looking at.
I'm glad that you said it the way you did, because now I have a follow up here.
Yeah.
You've been following any of what's been coming out of the DeSantis press room over the past few days, ever since he dropped out?
He's supporting Texas. That's about all I've heard.
He is really, in my opinion, being the Ron DeSantis everybody needed to see to right. choose him in this election.
Yeah.
I might have mentioned this to you earlier in the week. Why? Why now?
Why now and not on his campaign? I think because I really don't think he wanted to run against Trump. I think maybe he was timid.
Let me ask you a follow-up question real quick. Do you think that – do you think Ron DeSantis is a worse politician than Donald Trump?
Now that I've seen two totally different sides of him, I don't know how to really answer that.
Well, you saw a personal change, but nothing changed in his governance per se.
Not while he was in Florida, but he seemed like a totally different politician while he was campaigning.
I agree.
And that's why I'm really hesitant to jump to an answer on that question. You know, I'd have to think about it. I still think DeSantis is a hugely important figure in the conservative movement, not Republican movement, conservative right. movement going forward. I think that potentially, if he can be himself, potentially run a more genuine campaign where maybe he wants to get in it, because like I said, I don't think he had the sense that he wanted to. I think he could be a great successor to, if Trump isn't elected, the next great Republican president. I think that's definitely a possibility. I would love to see it. I mean, agree with the guy and everything, right? Like, just kind of like with Trump, I think he comes with less baggage. He probably is, well, now that he was governor of Florida, right? He has experience as an executive, but now so does Trump, right? So you can't really make the argument that he's more experienced than Trump, but he certainly has less baggage. I think he's very smart, policy-wise, all around. I think he's very solid, and I like him. Always did like him, for the most part. I mean, of course, there's things where, you know, you could say, I nitpick here, I nitpick there, I didn't agree with this. But he seemed like he was a little bit influenced by his donor money from the beginning. Like, I honestly think that's why he decided to run against Trump. I think the whole campaign was disingenuous. I don't think he wanted to run against Trump because he knows he owes his political career to him. And to see him kind of bastardize Trump was disingenuous from the beginning to me. And then to see him come right out or drop out of the race and then come right out and then endorse Trump was also disingenuous to me. So I think all right. around, it just seems kind of off. And I think it has to be monetarily motivated, donor motivated.
That was really my question. Do you think that's why you saw the Ron DeSantis that we did?
That's what scares me about him.
That's okay. So I want to close the show on this thought experiment, and we might go for another 20 minutes on this, but I want to stay on this topic here. All right. How much is the money behind the wall that we don't see? How much is this money affecting the people that we see and the policy that gets implemented? I'm on the verge of willing to claim with almost certainty that it's 100%. And the reason that I would like to give is the change you're seeing in Trump, the change in DeSantis, the change in Vivek, the change in Nikki. That stuff is all easily explained, in my opinion. Easily explained by they are lower rung people. They're more easily affected by donors. If they say they can foot your whole campaign, why wouldn't you run? Right? And I understand that.
Exactly.
When you talk about Trump's position, it doesn't make sense to me that I know he's not a stupid guy. He's a very intelligent man. There's only one way to get to the level of power in even before 2016 that Trump attained. There's only one way to do it, and it is through not only intelligence, but the ability to slit throats. And he just has changed. He doesn't have that fiery, I have a point to prove and I'm about to prove it. He doesn't have that bravado that he had back in 2016. Even in 2020, he didn't have the same campaign running ability, I think.
As 2016. It seemed different. He seemed more worn out. He seemed more tired. But the color of his hair is different.
Agreed. But to me, it has nothing to do with him being overworked or he's unable to do it. I think it has to do with what's behind the scene that we were mentioning before that he can't talk about. I think it has a hell of a lot more to do with that. It might be guns pointed at his head if he says the wrong thing or does the wrong thing. It might be threats on his family. It might be threats on all of his businesses, in which might affect a lot more than just his family, right?
Right.
He might be looking out for a lot more interests than just himself, and I want people to know that. He might not be able to say it or show it, but there's a damn good chance that he's getting held feet to the fire, that if you don't do this, you're sinking on every front.
So do you know, so remember how we just talked about how potentially when a second term president, from the moment they're sworn in, can be viewed as a lame duck? With that being said, if Trump were to be reelected, he can't run again. He can't be president for another term. Is that potentially when a lot of what we're speculating that he may know that can't necessarily, he may not necessarily be able to talk about.
It would be the time for it to come out.
That comes out.
It would be the time for it, if there is ever a time for it. That's absolutely true.
Like, for example, if he was to pardon somebody like, I'm not even going to throw names out there, but if a president is going to do a controversial pardon, right, it's always at the very end of their presidency, right?
Right.
Whether it's their one term incumbent getting voted out, or it's at the end of their second term, that's when, you know, the controversial pardons come out. At 11:55 on Inauguration Day, right? Right before. Right. It could be kind of like the same logic applied to maybe information this time. We don't know, but I totally agree with you. And I think you're lying if you don't notice the fact that Trump doesn't have the edge he used to. He's still a very energetic and an entertaining guy. But 2016 was just different. Like, the verbiage he used, how he acted, what he said, it was a little bit more blunt, and that's hard to say because it's Trump, but I think he was a little more unhinged, honestly, and I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but he had less chill, if you want to put it in colloquial terms.
He didn't have a filter. One thing I'd like to speculate, and obviously I have no idea if this is the truth or not, but I would say going into 2016 they had no baggage on him. Going into 2020, they did, and
they had more baggage.
They had
baggage on him going into 2016.
He didn't have baggage. They didn't have baggage that would upend his presidency. They had baggage that would smear shit on him, but he's had shit smeared on him since in the 80s, 70s, when he started his business venture. So,
when he ran for president. Remember the Access Hollywood tape? They thought the end of his campaign.
They did, but I think they knew better. They were just starting to build up this train of what they're trying to portray Trump as.
Right.
And now I think you see the full-fledged attack.
And for whatever reason, it's like throwing water on a grease fire. I don't know why that is. We can speculate about
that. Now you see the full-fledged attack, and what you're seeing is, like, if you look into the E. Jean Carroll case, okay, so I don't have a very great knowledge of this, and a lot of it has to do with, obviously, the facts have been tempered with at this point. Many people are saying many things that are obviously untrue. It's just a matter of how untrue are they, who's concocting it, where is it coming from your lawyer, coming from whatever. when you're looking at a case in what just happened with E. Jean Carroll case, okay, so if you just follow the fact train, so she alleged first, I believe, in 2017, or was it in 2015, right before he ran? It was either right before he ran in 2016 or right after he got in 2017. She alleged that running, I think it might have been 2015 or 2016. It was right as there. So, okay. She alleges, either way, she alleges he sexually assaulted her. And I don't think it was rape. It was a sexual assault that she alleged in 2015 or 2016. I believe that's what happened.
But it was back in the 90s, if I'm not mistaken.
But the original thing that happened, yes. But when she filed. Now, why it led to this was, I believe she was found not to have been raped, but to have been sexually assaulted. How she was able to prove this, it wasn't really proven. It was a civil case. You have to remember this is 20, 30 years after the original incident. So there was no evidence. This was all he said, she said. And the evidence that they had used to prosecute Trump was, I believe, one of the main things they like to point out was he said, "You're not my type." And so so that's the initial reaction is laughter, but in reality, what they're using it as is the fact that he's just willing
to admit that I would do that to someone else, but not you. That's how they're gonna twist.
So they're using it as a display of character of Trump in order to say that, okay, because he's willing to say something like that, he at least did something to you. Mm-hmm. With that, whenever Trump would speak publicly about the case, and obviously he was very inflammatory in these days. This was before he had any temper on him. He was alleged to have defamed her by her, of course. So she filed twice in 2019 and in 2022. This 2022 case is the case that we just watched unfold the other day.
Right? Yeah.
When you follow the track of fact there and how you even get a defamatory statement made by Trump, this is all stemming from an allegation of rape, which I believe was the original allegation was rape, which got knocked down to sexual assault. In the 90s or 80s, getting brought to the court 20 to 30 years later. When you have that buildup of events and then you can have a, like, this is where I think the unwillingness of one side to see the other side's argument, right? So yeah, Trump is obviously a loudmouth and he's going to continue to get himself into these situations because he feels like he's getting unjustly attacked. Well, do you think this is a just attack on somebody? Imagine that this was somebody that you knew, somebody, your brother, your father, maybe it's your husband, who all of a sudden one day comes home and is like, "Well, I have a case against me. What is it?" Well, I don't really know the woman, but she's alleging that I raped her in the 80s. I don't even know what I would do in that scenario. Hey, obviously, I wasn't alive, so it can't happen to me yet. But
are you kidding me? Like, are you joking? Like, I would laugh. I would think you're fucking with me.
But you have to, if you want to at least see the point of view of why this man is getting up and walking out of the court as the closing arguments are being made, if you want to understand why it got to that point, I think you have to understand the entirety of what this E. Jean Carroll case is and understand it's not just a defamation case.
I don't
blame
them
getting
out too. That's ridiculous.
Right. So it's just an example of, at least for me, I'm trying to justify, I guess, why Trump might act the way he does. But to me, it also points as to this guy. This guy is probably not the best representation, not by his own wrongdoing, but by the fact that he just has too much shit on his plate. And it doesn't really...
Does that mean they get their way then? Because that's what they wanted.
Exactly. Right? So that's where they want us to be. And really, as someone who... I would so much rather, and I'm sure a lot of Americans would, so much rather make a choice based on fact than actually feeling good about a candidate. It doesn't make me feel good pulling the voting trigger. It doesn't mean I won't do it.
Yeah. Not necessarily. So to be clear, not necessarily because you think he's guilty and you're on some moral high ground, but just because that you know that other people are going to have a problem with how one side tries to make him look.
I'm saying on a on just a surface level. I don't think he's the best candidate to represent America. I think he's got a lot of problems. But that being said, it doesn't mean I'm not going to vote for him when it comes down to the binary decision that's inevitably being forced down each and every one of our American throats. It's I'm sorry to term it that way, but it's true. There is a lot more capable people that are out there. Most of them are have absolutely nothing to do with politics, and that's just a sad truth. Is that,
you know, we don't know.
No, they have a platform. What I'm saying is they may not even want to ever engage in politics.
A year ago, no one even knew who Vivek Ramaswamy was, right? Or if you find someone like him who's an entrepreneur, right? He's cool. He has these ideas. He's very articulate and he's intelligent. But how do we get this person involved in politics, right?
Well, so that's my bigger point is there is that not only how do we get them involved, but I don't think it's possible to. If you're a smart businessman and things are going well and they're continuing to get better, especially with these mega policies that keep catering to you, what is the benefit to you to stop the gravy train and go into politics and fix the things that are actually going to be detrimental to you and your family's wealth in the future?
No, I think it is possible because, I mean, it's going to be rare because the logical person would say, yeah, why would you give up that lavish lifestyle? But I think, you know, barring any other sort of outside nefarious factors, right, when you have someone that does do that, I think that really speaks to the genuine place that they come from. And I know that's
not weird to
say about politics because a lot of it isn't all, you know, I'm going to come save the day, everyone's going to love me kind of thing. But I think there are genuinely people who do care, who do appreciate the opportunities that this country gave them, whether on, you know, on whatever side it may be, right? There's entrepreneurs who've ran on the other side that claim the same thing, but feel like they want to give back. And I think that comes from a more genuine place than someone who makes their career out of politics right out of college, right?
I'll just say this, Andrew, if that exists, that's what we need. You know, we're not going to have it in 2024. It's pretty obvious what we have coming down the pipe. That's what we need next.
In 2016.
That's, you know, I could agree with you there.
I don't know.
Maybe
Ramaswamy. I don't know.
My bigger point is I felt hell of a lot more comfortable saying that Trump was that possibility in 2016 than I do now. I would feel a hell of a lot better if there was someone at least sounding like they could be that mold, because right now there's not on the public stage. I do think that those people exist. I do think that there's a lot of great Americans that would be so much better at this job, like I was saying, than the people that we have to choose from. I don't think they want to be here, and I hope I'm wrong. I hope you're right that there will be one. It'll be rare, but there will be one. I just hope they come soon enough.
Well,
because I agree, they are rare. They exist.
He's going anywhere?
What's
is he one? I don't think Ramaswamy's going.
Ramaswamy? I'd have to see more. It's unfortunate that
he came kind of like too much. He kind of blindsided me too much. I had no idea who this guy was.
I agree. He also came in an election against Trump. If he came right after, I think it would make a lot more logical sense.
Which I didn't necessarily like. But when I hear him talk, when I hear all his talking points, he's not anti-Trump. He's anti-older generation, right?
Yes.
Ruling the world, essentially, right? And I think that he knew he wasn't going to gain any traction. But
he did put his name out there.
But he put his name in the hat. People know his name now. People know his policy, right? All of Ramaswamy's supporters, they're Trump supporters at the end of the day. They'll be DeSantis supporters at the end of the day. So from Ramaswamy's perspective, strategically, I think it was a better move for him to throw his hat in the ring now than in 2028.
I would agree with that 100%.
When he is trying to build traction and name recognition in 2028 when he has a legitimate chance versus now, right? He has the name recognition now.
Sowing that seed.
Right. If he was to reemerge in 2028, well, I think he has a better shot then, even if it's not for the executive president position, if, you know, he might be considered as a VP pick, a candidate pick down the road in 2028 because of...
Or maybe running for a Senate position now.
Yeah, or that too. But I think that's where he was coming from. I don't think it's because he was. I know he's not anti-Trump. He's not.
He's definitely not. I'd be very interested, and I hope
Tim Scott, or I even have questions about Ron DeSantis now too. But going back,
a lot of questions about Ron DeSantis.
Disingenuous. You know, Tim Scott talked a lot of smack about Donald Trump on the debate stage, and then he's there. You know, New Hampshire night or Iowa night, whichever
he's
one.
He's the leading. I believe he's the leading of. You know, you don't have any sort of true knowledge of who the VP pick is going to be, but he's the leading like odds to be VP pick at this point.
And to
it
me,
doesn't make any sense.
To me, how is that going to work? You have someone who is trashing you and your policy and what you, the actions you took on a debate stage, running actively against you, vehemently against you. And then one, you have him on stage after a caucus or a primary, pumping up the crowd. And then having your name in the conversation for a VP pick.
For me, it doesn't make any sense to me either, man.
When Ramaswamy was on the stage, really pumping up the crowd. He gave a great speech, by the way, in my opinion. That was more genuine because he wasn't on the stage so vehemently opposing a lot of what Trump did. Wasn't saying necessarily nasty things about him, but made the differentiation.
He made it very policy-centric, which made it much more advantageous for at least being a VP pick, even.
It was principle-centric because he was saying, the only gripe I have with Donald Trump is the age. I think it's time for a new generation of leaders to step up. And I think that sentiment resonates with a lot of people, a lot of people. And he's right. I think he's absolutely right. And you contrast that with Tim Scott. He was going after him pretty much on policy and action. And I remember in one of the debates, Ramaswamy said, he was like, you know, you're not going to agree with 100% of what someone says or does, but with about 80 to 90% of everything Trump said and did policy wise, I agreed with. And he was the best president we've had in the 21st century so far. And that statement, the last one, the he was the best president so far in the century, got oohs and ahs and what are you talking about? And then he said, he goes, what are you guys booing at? He's like, between Clinton, Bush, and Obama, it's not even a choice in the presidents we've had so far this century. Technically,
I like that.
Technically, Clinton was president in the century for like 3 weeks, so you have to count him. But still, it's not even between Bush and Obama. It's not even. I don't understand how you can make an argument against that.
I agree. I love it. I think
people would say Obama's was a better president than Obama and Bush, and I can understand that argument. That makes more sense to me. But if you're going to have a Republican, if you're at a Republican debate, raising question marks about whether or not Trump was the greatest president of this century so far, you're essentially saying Obama was a better president, because we know Bush certainly. Right. Wasn't, but you're essentially saying Obama was a better president, which it makes no sense to me.
Right. Well, I think it'll be very interesting to see the continuation of Vivek's career, if he pursues 2028 with vigor or if he holds back. And yeah, because I do have a lot of hope for the future if we can get there.
If we can stop these tax and spend Republicans and Democrats, and kind of just whether you have a D or an R next to your name, right? If you could be logical, if you can have like a listen, I'm not a huge fan of Fetterman, but if you can have someone who can point to the reality and say, like, listen, like, sure, we can have immigration into this country, we want to give people a chance, but we can't just have anybody walking in, contrasting with like the Ramaswamy of like, we also need to clean ourselves up culturally in this country here, right? If we can like kind of join those two ideologies, or have people on generally different sides of the aisle that can kind of come together and maybe even form a presidential ticket like that, I think that is what's going to truly be unstoppable and point us toward the direction that we're talking about before with getting presidents in a line that are aligned with one another's vision.
I would agree there. I think that's a good point.
Accomplish something.
That's a good point. I think we should end it there, but the future of the United States might just depend on the fact that we are going to need to see in the future either a Democratic presidential electee choosing either Republican senator,
right,
or Republican House member, or even a Republican presidential running mate to try to band together and get a coalition of like-minded voters who at least see enough issues in the middle to work outwardly.
That's right.
Get shit done. And or vice versa, of course, where you have a Republican nominee working with the other side. I think that's a great way to envision a possibility of future development of the country and being able to work together. I think that's what it's got to be.
Yeah, I do too. I think we circled back nicely there, as Jen Psaki would say.
Jen Psaki. All right, man. For everybody else, love for you to go share, comment, subscribe. Biggest thing is go rate us on iTunes and Spotify. People see that, the number goes up higher. We start comparing. Game over. Everybody else, catch you on the next one. Andrew, love you, kid. Thanks for coming.
Adios.
Damn, I wish I were the fucking state. I want to be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'ma keep dreaming.